Good evening, everybody. My name is Amy Kuhnlein, and I am chair of Young Friends of the Kansas City Public Library. We support the library to put on fun events like this, where we bring in authors and we present programs and social events. And so if you enjoy coming to these kind of events, we strongly urge you to become a friend. Get friendly with your library. And those memberships can really help our library spread further into our community by doing more and keeping our library free and accessible for everybody. And I'm going to turn that over to Ms. Katie Stover.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Katie Meditor Stover, the Director of Reader Services for the Kansas City Public Library. Welcome to the Central Library and this evening's event featuring Mallory O'Meara, author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon. I suppose that you're thinking that we brought you this book on this subject because it's October, and that's certainly an easy connection to make, but I'm hoping that we dive a little deeper this evening. But first, a word about things that scare monsters. Did you know that monsters are afraid of silent cell phones? So if you put yours on silent right now, I can guarantee you'll keep the monsters away. While reading about Millicent Patrick, the lady behind the creature, and Mallory, the relentless writer researching her life, I wondered, what is a monster? And being the good librarian I am, I turned to the dictionary. No, I did not go to Google for that. And the dictionary is pretty terse. It says, typically, a monster is an abnormal, strange, terrifying creature. And so I thought about that, because Millicent wasn't a normal woman for her time. And she had a strange upbringing and a terrifying amount of artistic talent. So much so that it frightened people Millicent worked with and eventually cost Millicent her profession. Does that make her a monster? And to some members of the film industry, apparently it did. And that's some of the story Mallory will share with you tonight. The abnormal, strange, and sometimes terrifying experiences Millicent endured during her too short artistic career behind the camera. But what you'll actually learn tonight is what it takes to make a monster. It takes a woman who can witness and endure monstrous behavior, and instead of letting it kill her, turn it into cinematic art. Now that's a final girl standing twist, if you ask me. And the only thing that may horrify you is why so many of us never knew about Millicent's contribution to movie magic and film history. There's the real horror story. In The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Mallory O'Meara makes no bones about loving horror and the many formats where fans can find it. Movies, television, books, and art. She can't talk about it all night long tonight, so tune into her podcast, Reading Glasses, to hear more literary and reader-related chat, or cue up Kids vs. Monsters. It's one of the first movies she produced. Spoiler alert, it's a horror film. She's a big fan of Twin Peaks and Grady Hendrix, who is the funniest horror writer you are not reading right now. So go check him out before you leave. And she's pretty funny herself on Twitter. So please welcome Mallory O'Meara, the woman behind The Lady from the Black Lagoon.
I'm waiting for to say this my whole life. Is this thing on? This is great. Awesome. Hi, thank you everyone for coming out tonight. Happy best absolute month of the year. This is my most powerful month as a goth, so I'm excited to share this all with you. So I wrote a book called The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. But who the heck is Millicent Patrick? Millicent Patrick, I always like to describe as the Forrest Gump of the 1950s. She most notably designed the creature from the Black Lagoon, one of Universal's classic pantheon of monsters, and he was actually the last one to be included. I mean, everyone has their own pantheon. You can come fight me later, but my opinion, Creature was the last one, but she did so, so much more. She was one of Disney's first female animators. She was an actress. She was an illustrator. Every single thing about Millicent Patrick was larger than life. It has been the greatest honor of my life so far to tell her story. So if you've read the book, you know that there are, if you've read the hardcover version, you know that there are pictures in there because Millicent lived a very visual, cinematic life. So I have a treat for all of you. I've got some photos that have never been seen before. I have hundreds and hundreds of them that I was not allowed by my publisher to put in because we could not fit 700 different photos in the book. So I would like to sort of take you through, while telling you about Millicent and why she is a trailblazing artist and one of the most important women we've ever had in the film industry, and also why we don't know her any longer. But I'd like to take you through her life for a little bit with some awesome photos. So here's my girl. So Millicent Patrick began life, she grew up in a place called Hearst Castle. Now, if Cribs was a TV show back in the 1920s, Hearst Castle would have been on it, and I'm not kidding you, this is what it looked like. So Hearst Castle was the summer home, just one of many, of a man named William Randolph Hearst, and he was America's first media mogul. So not only did he have this incredible, amazing home, one of many, but people like Charlie Chaplin and Winston Churchill used to go and, like, you know, hang out at the ranch, as they would say. And this is where Millicent Patrick grew up, because her father was a man named Camille Rossi, and he was the superintendent of construction here for 10 years. So this is where she started life. Like I said, everything in Millicent's life was bigger, more bombastic than anyone could dream. And this is where she grew up. This is where her and her siblings hung out. They used to play here while her dad was getting into fights and trying to figure out how to make this thing. And so Millicent always was a great artist. She was an amazing pianist, but when she got into community college, she decided that she really wanted to make a go of art. So she decided to go to apply for a scholarship to go to the Chouinard Institute. So this woman right here, I've been told that I'm allowed to swear. I'm making sure there are no children. This woman was a complete badass. Her name is Nelbert Chouinard, and just a year after women were allowed to vote in this country, she opened an art school in Southern California that was about to change the face of art schools. She was incredible. She ran the school with an iron fist and artistic flair, and I want to share some unseen drawings of Millicent's. That's her modeling. So the really cool thing about the Chouinard Institute is not just that it was created by Nelbert, who was absolutely amazing, but the thing that Nelbert was really, really good at was working with students and teachers and lecturers and trying to get more cool people in for her school. And one day, an artist came to her from an up-and-coming movie studio, and he wanted to make animated films, and he really wanted to get his artists trained in a special way because he had a vision for how to change how animated films were made and how they looked. This man was called Walt Disney. You probably have heard of him. And the problem is, this was early days in the art in the world of Disney, and he didn't have money to train all these animators, but he knew that they needed to be trained differently. This was not a time period where there was, like, you could take an animation course at school. That he needed to train his artists in a special way. So he's going to all these art schools all around Southern California, and he asked them, he's like, hey, I can't pay you, but I really want to bring my students here, and they all said no. Except for our lady, Nelbert. She said, you know what, Walt, bring your students on down. We'll figure something out. So a pipeline formed between the Chouinard Institute and Disney. Like, Disney would literally, in his Buick, drive his students down to Chouinard and wait for them while they were in class and just, like, hang out around the school. So that's how this sort of pipeline got formed, because he got to see the best talent at the Chouinard Institute, and that included Millicent Patrick. So he started hiring animators and artists from Chouinard, and while his animators were hanging out at Chouinard and learning things there, and sometimes the instructors over at Chouinard would come up and help him work on his film, so there was a really close connection there. And he met Millicent. And he was looking at her art, and Millicent's art was very, very special in the way that she was able to really convey a lot of movement in just a few lines. And that's perfect for animation. So he said, please come work for me. So he hired her originally to work in a place called the Ink and Paint Department. If you are interested in women's history at Disney, I really, really suggest you buy a book by Mindy Johnson called Ink and Paint, because a lot of people don't realize in the early days of Disney, you know, there's a lot of different steps to animation. You don't just, like, take a drawing and wave it in front of a camera. There's a lot of things you have to do. And a lot of the animators were at that time all men, but the people taking those animators' drawings and inking them onto these clear cells so they could be shot with a camera and then painted, they were 100% women. This was a massive building on the Disney studio lot that was staffed 100% by women. In fact, men weren't even allowed to go in the building for a multitude of reasons. Interior office dating was really discouraged at Disney Studios. But that's where Millicent started. And she was so talented. She started as a painter and then became an inker. And people noticed her skill at conveying all this movement. So she became one of the very, very first female animators at Disney, along with a woman named Marcia James and another woman named Retta Scott. Here's her doing a drawing of somebody you might know. Pretty cool. You can see the style of these rabbits is from Snow White. And so the first thing that Millicent worked on was a very, very ambitious new film that Disney wanted to do. For that, even by today's standards, if you pitch this film, some executive would go, this is a stupid idea. We're not going to do this. Because it's basically a giant music video. They wanted to do all these different short films that were set to classical pieces of music. And everyone thought it was a stupid idea. He's like, no, he really wanted to, because this is the early days of animation still. People really still didn't understand it. He wanted to elevate the art form. So that's how the movie called Fantasia was born. And Millicent was hired on to be in the special effects department because this was a totally different type of movie. People had never done anything like this before. And so they needed new ways of animating. And what Disney wanted was he wanted the look of pastel in a lot of these shots. How many people in this audience have seen Fantasia? Lots of people. Amazing. Great. If you haven't seen it, great film. Totally holds up. He wanted the look of pastel, but you can't animate with pastel because it's chunky and chalky and it's going to melt all over the place. Terrible. So he needed to figure out how to paint in a way that looked like pastel. And it was what's called, ta-da, the pastel effect. That's what Millicent Patrick did. So you can, if you learn to look for the sort of like soft pastel-y effect, you can see it throughout Fantasia. It was used a lot. So Millicent and Marcia James were hired to do that in the studio. And there were a bunch of different sequences that they were working on. And before I show you this next slide, this is sort of a big reveal in the book, but I want to tell you. So when I was a kid, I watched a lot of movies, read a lot of books, and a lot of people, now I'm a huge horror fan, and I've been for a long time, and people always want to know, well, how did, you look like a nice lady, why are you into all this weird stuff? Besides the fact that I look very weird. And I tell them, when I was a kid, my grandfather showed me Fantasia, and I loved it. It was fun. You know, it's a fun kids movie. And it's like, you know, hippopotamuses and tutus and dancing brooms. Awesome, fun, cool. Until it got to the Night on Bald Mountain sequence. And all of a sudden, game changer. It was the very first time art made me feel something that powerful. Even though it was terror, it really affected me. And I knew something was different. And it was the very, very first time that art affected me in such a way that I thought about it afterwards. And I have really bad anxiety. I've always had anxiety. And it was the very first time I was afraid of something that wasn't real, which if you have anxiety, you know, what a vacation that is. And I was hooked. I fell in love. So when I found out that Millicent also animated Chernabog, my favorite animated monster, it blew my mind and made me feel like I was on the right path to try to find this incredible woman. Also, fun Halloween October fact, one of the models for Chernabog was none other than Bela Lugosi. And if you rewatch the film and you see his hand movements and his arm movements, you can totally see. And I have gotten to see that picture. I couldn't print it in the book, even though I tried. But him modeling as Chernabog is absolutely incredible. So this was the first film that Millicent worked on as an animator. This is a picture of her at Disney Studios with the woman named Retta Scott, the blonde woman. So she was the first credited female animator. And as you will see in the book, or you know if you've already read it, credits back then in movies were really difficult. And credits back then in movies with animated films were even more difficult because there's hundreds and hundreds of people who work on animated films and a lot of different people are working on things at the same time. And when you're talking about who the first female animator is, you have to decide, was that the first person who drew a drawing that was going to be animated? Was that the first person who saw a drawing of hers animated on the big screen, a film that was completed? It's such a weird gray area, so I don't ever feel comfortable saying that, yes, Millicent was the first female animator, because it's not like a big lever that you pull that says animate on it, and Millicent was the first woman to ever do that. But she definitely was one of the first, and until some secret hidden behind-the-scenes footage comes out of something, that's where I'm going to stand. But Retta was the first woman who was credited on screen as being an animator for Bambi. A lot of amazing female powerhouses back then in the Disney world. But there was, speaking of powerhouses, there was a lot of turmoil happening at Disney. So Millicent only worked there for a couple years before a union strike and Millicent's own struggle with migraines caused her to quit Disney, and she never worked in animation ever again. So what she did do was take advantage of those good looks of hers and become a model. She was very, very good at it, and she lived in Los Angeles at this time, which is a great place if you want to get into this industry. There's a lot of pipelines already in place for taking beautiful people and putting them in front of various cameras. And she was very, very good at it. She had the looks. She was a very gregarious person. She was a very charming person. She really loved being in this world. And so that's sort of how she segued into modeling. But the thing is, while she was modeling, she was still working on her art. She loved being an artist. She would still sketch all the time, do portraits for friends. And one day, while she was waiting after a trade show that she had just modeled at, literally waiting on the corner, just sort of waiting for the bus, a Hollywood producer came up to her, and I mean, I can't make, so a lot of the stuff about Millicent's story, like, oh, did you make that stuff up for the book? No, you can't make this stuff up. He asked her if she wanted to be in the pictures, and she said yes. So she started a lot of work on the Universal, Columbia, Paramount backlots as a background actress. She always stood out in whatever scene she was in because she was very, very beautiful. And that's how she got back into the film industry. So even while she was doing all of this, she was still modeling, but she really, really loved being in front of the camera. She actually got her first taste of this while she was still working at Disney. How many people have heard or seen a film called The Reluctant Dragon? The Reluctant Dragon is sort of a big commercial for Disney Studios that's disguised as a movie. There was a comedian back during that time at Disney. And it just shows him, the whole plot of the film is him trying to go to Disney to pitch Walt Disney, which is, God, what a nightmare now. Can you imagine? He'd have to like dig a hole underneath Disney studio lots to get in. But he's just on the studio lot and he's trying to find Disney. He's trying to pitch them his idea for a film. But as he goes through the studio, you see like various clips of short films and you see him moving around on the studio lot. And in the background of one of those scenes where there's a group of animators sketching an elephant is Millicent Patrick. She just loved being on camera. So as she got into the world of background acting and just acting in general, she just fell in love. She loved the life of it. She was a really big personality. But while she was on set, if you are an actor yourself or you've ever made a film, you know there's a lot of downtime. The phrase hurry up and wait was probably invented on a film set. So while she was doing that, she was doing a lot of sketching. She was still doing a lot of art. It was still her biggest passion. And one day, she was waiting in the makeup chair, and one of her favorite things to do was sketch portraits of her co-stars. And she absolutely loved doing it, and she had showed all these, it was a Universal Studios film, and she had all these great sketches, and she showed them to the man who ran the makeup studio there, a man named Bud Westmore. Now, I want to take a moment, if you know, you know, if you don't, you don't. Bud Westmore, I'm always surprised that there's never been a film or TV series made about the Westmore family. So Bud Westmore ran the Universal makeup studio there, the Monster Shop. When I say makeup, I mean beauty makeup, but I also mean scary aliens. Anything put on a face was makeup. And he came from the Westmore dynasty of makeup. Think The Mob, but with lipstick. This was a true dynasty. His father, George Westmore, was quite literally the man who invented the idea of a makeup department. Back when George came to Hollywood from the UK, they didn't have that. That like early black and white films that came from a theater tradition, so all the actors and actresses put on their makeup themselves. Didn't always work, because there was no quality control. So he came on, literally just barged onto studio sets and said, hey, what if I did this? And that way it would look consistent from scene to scene. And they said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. So he said, all right, I'll do it, and got hired, and he started the idea of a makeup department. And he had a bunch of sons, and all of them went into makeup, and it became a dynasty. There was a certain point back in the 40s and 50s when there was a Westmore brother heading up almost every single major studio, makeup-wise. You do not want to piss off the Westmores. They were from Paramount to Eagle Lion, which is now defunct Universal, Warner Brothers. They all ran the makeup studios there. So catching the eye of a Westmore was a big deal. And so Millicent showed him these sketches. He was completely blown away, and he really wanted to hire her. Because the thing about Bud Westmore and the thing about all of the Westmores is that they were beauty people. They had their own, actually Millicent illustrated this, even though they didn't credit her. We'll get back to that later. But they had their own book called The Westmore Book of Beauty that was all like, have you ever taken a quiz in a magazine that said like, ooh, what eyebrows should you have for your face shape? They invented that stuff. If you've ever despaired because you have a round face like me, I'm like, oh God, I can't have the eyebrows I want. Blame the Westmores. So they were beauty people. They had a massive salon on Sunset Boulevard that was called the House of Westmore, of course, and it was like everyone rich and famous went there. So they were not monster people. They were not horror people. They were not alien people. They were not creature people. So Bud really needed somebody on set who could do character stuff and could do more art stuff, because he, as the head of a big makeup studio, he wasn't doing a lot of the designing. He was doing a lot of the admin work, and he was a beauty guy in the first place. So he really needed someone whose creative talents were very different from his own. So he saw Millicent and was like, absolutely, I'm going to hire you. And she became the first woman to ever be hired by a makeup studio makeup department at a big studio. The very, very first woman to do this. These are her amazing. She was just so good. She was incredible. So she was the very, very first one. And this was a very interesting time in Hollywood. This was the mid-50s. And we went from being afraid of Europe to being afraid of space. We were starting to be afraid of the Russians. We were afraid of nuclear war. We were afraid of the skies. We were afraid of spaceships and aliens. So all of a sudden, we had this new thing called science fiction. And all of the classic monster movies that Universal had really built as this backbone for its company back in the 30s were all, you know, Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein, those kinds of horror movies. They had never done a science fiction movie before. But all of a sudden, the kids wanted the sci-fi, so they had to figure out how to make a sci-fi movie. And that in itself was a new thing, because all of a sudden they had a new audience that they had never had to cater to before. It's a very terrifying, still terrifying audience. Teenagers. Before, they had this massive group of teenagers who had pocket money, who had time. This was when the suburbs were a thing, you know, and they wanted to get these kids out of the house. Their parents wanted to get them out of the house, so the best place for them to be was at the movies. So they wanted to make sci-fi movies for kids to go see. So they started cooking something up. And so Millicent went from designing beauty makeups, which she had been doing for a while at Universal, and they were really happy with her work, and they wanted her to design an alien. So they took this very, very beautiful woman, and she, at this time, she was still doing background work, and she was still doing acting, but she was transitioning to doing more and more work on the Universal lot. It was more pay. I don't know if it was more fulfilling for her, but there was a lot less waiting around. So they came up with this idea for a movie they wanted to do called It Came From Outer Space. And the treatment for it was written by an author that I love very much, and many of you might know, a man named Ray Bradbury. And it was actually a very thinly veiled anti-McCarthyism movie. But Ray Bradbury wrote a treatment for this, and if you've ever read any Bradbury, you know that he is very verbose and not always detailed. So he gave Millicent essentially this block of text that even had the word nebulous in it, and Millicent had to design it. But she did. She designed the alien for it. The film was made. It did well for Universal. It was Universal's very, very first science fiction movie. And it became a classic. It's very still cheesy, as many 1950s sci-fi movies are. I would describe it as sort of like an eyeball that's been left in a bag. It has legs. But back in the 50s, that was really scary. It was really intense, so there was a lot of people who were frightened by it, and Millicent was very creative and innovative with her designs, and she had come up with all these different ways to figure it out. She came up with this massive page full of designs, which actually Bud Westmore saved and used later. We'll get to that much later. A lot to say about Bud Westmore. But he was like, this is great. I want you to keep doing this monster thing. We have a new movie that we want to do, and this one's going to be bigger and better, higher budget. It's called, I'm not going to tell you because you have to read the book, but it was not called Creature from the Black Lagoon at the beginning. It had a much stupider name. They went through many silly names for Creature from the Black Lagoon. But this monster that she had to design was going to be completely different. There's a reason why Creature from the Black Lagoon is still known and still really iconic right now. He's the only Universal classic monster that's never been remade. And no, you cannot count Shape of Water because it's not from Universal, even though I do in my heart. Shape of Water would not exist without Creature from the Black Lagoon. He's the only monster that had to go underwater. He's the only Universal classic monster that had to be played by two different actors. He's the only one that was out in daylight. So Millicent really, really had to up her game with this one. This monster had to be complete. He had to be very detailed. There was a lot of technical elements to the design. I can swear, and she fucking nailed it. She really, really did. It's still one of the most famous monsters today. I mean, even people who haven't seen the movie, they see a picture of Creature and they know that is Creature from the Black Lagoon. And the reason why I think Millicent's design has stood the test of time is, one, because she had that Disney training, so just a few lines. With just a few lines, Millicent could convey a lot of movement. She can convey a lot of emotion. There's a lot of people nowadays who are used to high-tech makeup and CGI, and they see the film and they think, man, you know, is that a makeup? Is that an articulated mask or something? No, it's just a piece of one piece of rubber. But because of the way Millicent designed it, when the two actors, Ben Chapman and Riku Browning, were in the suit and moving the head, it looks like a makeup. And the other thing that I think, besides that, that Disney training, was her incredible empathy. Millicent designed this monster wanting people to feel for him. So when you look at him, you're scared. You're scared by him. There's a lot of kids who ran out of that theater, including Alice Cooper when he was a kid. But you want to understand him. He looks just human-like enough. And it is very, if you've ever watched a lot of cheesy sci-fi movies, you are aware. It is very difficult to make a monster like this that doesn't look silly. But nobody was laughing at Creature, except for Bud Westmore. Bud Westmore did not like this design. He thought it wasn't going to hold up. He thought it was a ridiculous idea to put a monster like that out in daylight. He thought it was going to be, please, no pun intended, but a flop. But they still went through the movie. The producers loved it. Everyone else thought it was going to be great. The film was shot, and people started taking some notice. They started doing test screenings, and they didn't have to edit anything. People absolutely love the film, and they love the creature. That was the big thing. They absolutely love the creature. Here's Bud Westmore himself displaying Millicent's design with Millicent's drawings. And yes, those original drawings of Creature are Creature from the Black Lagoon fans' white whale. No one knows what happened to them. I'm hoping that there's like a collector somewhere in the middle of nowhere somewhere that has them, and he will fall into a volcano, and then they will be released into the world, but nobody knows where these drawings are. They do not know if they still exist. Unfortunately, I would give any amount of toes, to even just see them. But this is Millicent and Bud working in the monster shop. So all of a sudden, Universal realized that they had a hit with this film. And so this was where Millicent would work every day. And she marched in there every day in her heels and her pearls and her beautiful dresses, because that Millicent loved to dress every day. And she was just like totally cool with being the only woman there. She was unapologetically feminine. She was unapologetically herself. She loved the work. She loved working with this team. She loved the designing. She even loved Bud Westmore. So apparently in the beginning got along very, very well. And this is here. Actually, here she is right now adding some paint to the suit when they had to test it underwater. So this is from a shoot called it's the infamous tank test, where they were testing it in a water tank on the Universal lot. So they started coming up with ideas to promote it, just like today. Milkshakes at McDonald's, ridiculous toys. Still, no social media back then, but you know, since the dawn of time, Universal Studios and other big movie studios have tried to come up with ways to sell their movies. So Universal was like, okay, well, how are we going to get people to like this movie? How are we going to get people to come see it? And they came up with all these wacky ideas. And one of the less wacky ideas was somebody on the Universal publicity team thought, hey, we have this beautiful woman. And she's very, you know, charming. She's very gracious. She's very well-spoken. And she designed this thing. Why don't we send her out on tour and promote it, the beauty who created the beast. She's the perfect promotional platform. And everyone was like, oh yeah, this is fantastic. So the wheels started turning on this tour. This is when the problems with Bud Westmore come in. Because back then, when you saw a movie, the couple of title cards you saw at the beginning of the film, that was all the credits. Right now, when you go see a film, especially if you go see, you know, the new Marvel movie, there is a 10-minute end crawl at the end of the movie. Every single person who's ever even thought about that movie has been credited. Which, to be fair, movies are really hard to make, and that is great. But that's not how things were back then. And so Bud Westmore, as the head of the Universal makeup department, he got sole credit for everything everybody in the department did on every single film. And back then, there was no IMDb, there was no Twitter, there was nothing like that to check. So people weren't even thinking about that. People weren't, you know, the public wasn't going, hey, the key grip on this was not given any credit. People didn't even know. So even though he was not doing the designing, he was not doing the sculpting, he was not doing the molding, he got credit for everything. And that suited him just fine. That's the kind of person he was. And when he found out that all of a sudden they were going to take this woman and let everybody know that he did not do the design for a design that he didn't even like, he got really mad. Really, really mad. Because you're sitting there and you're thinking, if you haven't read this book, you're like, wow, this woman is amazing. She did all these cool things. She's this trailblazing woman. You know, why doesn't she have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? Why don't we know who she is? This is why. So he kicked up a huge fuss at Universal, and they said, okay, all right, well, we've already got some of the plans in place. We'll rebrand the tour. And instead of the beauty who created the Beast, she'll be the beauty who lives with the Beast, and we'll pitch her as someone who takes care of all the Universal monsters. So she got to go from Creature's creator to Creature's roommate, or like babysitter, I guess, somewhere in there. She got demoted into this like motherly role, which is not a bad thing, I guess, if she was Creature's actual mom, but she designed him. And I don't know whether or not she knew of what the tour was supposed to be, but when they pitched that to her, she agreed. And so what they were going to do is, after years of trying to shun their monster movie background, they brought all Frankenstein, they brought all those monster masks out of the vault, and they're like, all right, we want to really show off our monster movie pedigree here. So Millicent got to go, was slated to go all over the country with all of these masks. Some of the ones she did design, the one that she's wearing on her head, is one of the masks from Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. She did do other monster movies while this was all happening. And she was going to display them and like sort of be like, oh, yes, I am the beauty who takes care of them. I guess like brushing out the Wolfman and spritzing Creature with mist, I guess. I don't know what she needs to do there. But so it was slated. She was going to go on this massive promotional tour all over the country. And the movie came out while this was happening. And before she left, she had a meeting with Bud and the people at Universal, and she had to promise that she would lie to everybody and tell them that she did not design this. She had a script that she had to read from. She had a chaperone with her to make sure that she stuck to the script. And every single date that she did, every interview that she did, that said that Bud Westmore was the credit for the person. And she had some of the other names of the people who worked on it, Jack Kevin, Chris Mueller, but she was not allowed to take credit for her own work. She agreed, because this was the 1950s, and that's what was expected, and they were going to pay her very well. She did negotiate for a higher salary, which, good on you, Millicent. But she had to lie. So she went off. She went off on tour and did all kinds of radio interviews, magazines, newspapers, TV spots. I've been trying to find them. I never have been able to. And people were dazzled. The movie was out in theaters. People were loving it. People already fell in love with the creature. She started getting fan mail because she was so friendly and smart and interesting and passionate. And the way that she talked about her work and the way that she talked about Creature, you can just tell because she absolutely loved him. The problem was people started to figure out really quick that maybe it wasn't Bud Westmore who designed this. Maybe this woman who worked as a designer was the designer. I don't know why Bud thought that he would be able to like sweep this under the rug, but people started figuring it out. So people started doing pieces not even about the movie, but just about her. She was such an electric, interesting person, and back then there was such a huge dichotomy between this beautiful woman and this monster. It's like, ooh, isn't it crazy that this beautiful woman designed these monsters? I know, it's like almost like women are people, and people were fascinated by her. So she started to eclipse some of the Creature buzz. And back home at Universal, Bud was mad. So mad that he followed her progress across the country, and he would find out what newspapers and magazines and radio stations she spoke to and demand to ask to know what she said, what they were going to print. He was furious. This was all happening without her consent. She was still sticking to the script. She was still being chaperoned. But people were so interested in her, and people were quickly figuring out that she designed this, and they were printing this stuff without her say. Completely not her fault. But in his mind, as soon as Millicent had got off on her own, even though she was chaperoned, she was off taking all the credit, even though it was her credit to take. So while she was off having the absolute peak of her career, Bud Westmore fired Millicent Patrick, and she never worked behind the scenes on a film ever again. She came back from her tour. She came back to Los Angeles, and the film that she was working on, another classic sci-fi film called This Island Earth, she was pulled from. She was pulled from all of her projects, and she never worked on Universal Movie in that way ever again. That's why you don't know anything about Millicent Patrick, because there was no internet, there was no IMDb, and after that, after all of this, Bud Westmore, quickly realizing that now he had this opportunity to take credit for this monster, stepped in and was like, ah, yes, creature, my best friend that I designed all myself. Yes, wonderful. And that was it. There was no way to check. And even though she still received fan mail for years, because people remembered her and were excited by her, and there were girls and women all over the country that were so inspired by her, she disappeared. For 6 decades, nobody knew anything. They didn't even know if she was still alive. And because of that, nobody could follow in her footsteps. That includes me. When I first saw Millicent Patrick when I was 17 years old, there's a really interesting thing happened in the 90s. Is IMDb started up, and the internet started up. So all of a sudden, all of these photos that had never been seen before and these cool behind-the-scenes facts that no one had ever been able to share. We had the internet. We could put them on message boards and yell at each other on social media and do all these things that we love to do now. So stuff started to come out, and hardcore film nerds started talking about these things, and Creature became a beloved film. And people always wanted to know more about how he was created. And so all of a sudden, all these pictures started to show up. And the picture that I had showed you with Millicent painting the creature, working, like, not a posed publicity shot, just a picture of her on set working on her work, that started floating around. And people knew her name, but they didn't know anything more about her. And I'm sort of the black sheep of my family, and not just because I'm goth. I didn't have any siblings who were into horror. I didn't have anyone to show me the way after I saw Night on Bald Mountain, so I had to teach myself. So when I was a teenager, I was like, great, I'm a Ravenclaw, so I did all my research, and I, thank you, shout out to the Ravenclaws. I've seen all the, I'm in a Ravenclaw heavy space right now, because we're in a library. So I wanted to do research. And I was like, okay, well, I gotta start with all the Universal classics. That's the big one. So I watched all of them. You know, I fell in love with the Wolfman, who's still my husband. And I got to the Creature, which is the last one. And I fell in love with him for, you know, the same way a lot of people did. But I fell in love with him not because, I mean, I love Julie Adams and I love that bathing suit. But I fell in love with that movie because I felt like Creature. I felt like that walking through the halls when I was a teenager. Like the way that he swims underneath Julie Adams in the movie, that's how I still feel when I look at hot people. And I'm dating a hot person and I still feel like that. I empathized with him so strongly. And I just wanted to know more about him and I wanted to know everything. So I went online, again, more Ravenclawing, and I wanted to know who made him, who designed him. And I was scrolling through Google image search and I found this photo of a woman working on the monster suit. And up until that point, all of my heroes were men. Jack Pierce, Rick Baker, Dick Smith, and Tom Savini, all of these masters of monster makeup. They're all dudes, and that's fine. But there were no women. I never even thought that I could be in that world. I was super content to be a monster fan and love the movies and read scary things, but I never even thought that I could do that, because I didn't see the way. That entire world, all the directors that I knew, it was all populated with people who didn't look like me until I saw Millicent. And here was this woman, not getting coffee, not being anyone's assistant. She was just doing her job. And underneath the picture, it had a caption that said, Millicent Patrick, animator and designer. And that was it. There was no Wikipedia page. There was nothing about her online, just some scattered photos and some like very unprofessional blogs. But that was it. That was all it took. It was like someone had poked a hole in this wall, and all of a sudden I could see through the other side. And she became a beacon for me, and actually several years later, I became a horror filmmaker, and she was my hero. She was the role model, only role model I had, and I clung to her, even though I had no idea anything about her. So I am covered in tattoos, as you might see, and I decided to get a tattoo of Millicent Patrick to remind me every single day that I belonged in the horror film industry, no matter how much I didn't feel it. No matter how much people tried to make me feel like I didn't belong, I knew that I did. And I knew that I did because Millicent did. So I got this tattoo of her, and A few weeks later, I was at a party, and a literary agent friend of mine was like, who is this woman that you got tattooed on you? And I said, oh, well, it's Melissa Patrick. She designed the creature from the Black Lagoon. And he's like, well, what happened to her? I was like, I don't know. No one knows anything about her. And he said, wow, that'd make a great book. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, that would make a great book. And I said, but I'm not a writer. And he said, well, I'll send you stuff for a nonfiction proposal, and you can figure it out. And so I thought, well, why not? I wanted to know so badly about what happened to her. Nobody knew anything. Even all of the blogs that were written about her were written by men. Nobody knew anything. So I just started. And now, if you're holding the book, you have it in your hands. I ended up finding everything. I got all the details, most of the details of her life, her death, her career, her personal life, and she remained my hero throughout all of it. You're probably wondering, this is great, you know, this wonderful woman, she blazed this trail, but it was 60 years ago. Why does this matter? You know, I had friends of mine who were not monster people while I was working on this and pouring all of my savings and all of my time and moved to Los Angeles for. They're like, why are you doing this for this woman you aren't even related to, you don't know anything about, and they worked on this monster movie that was back in the 1950s. Why does it matter? And it matters because what happened to Millicent Patrick still happens, and it's happening as I speak right now. It has happened to me. It has happened to every single woman that I know in the film industry. It has happened to every single woman I know in every single industry ever, whether you are a plumber or a chef or a tailor, whatever you do. The system and the problems that caused Millicent Patrick to lose her career are in place right now, 60 years later. It has been 60 years, and we have still not had another woman design a monster for a major motion picture. Think about that. 60 years have gone by, and we still do not have a monster designed by a woman. We just had a ton of really cool monster movies that came out. You know, new Predator movie, new Godzilla movie. Still, none of them have ever been designed by women. Because Millicent was hidden for so long, and girls like me did not have a role model, and we didn't know that we could do it too. We just went through another Oscar season for 2018, and that we couldn't cough up a single woman to nominate for Best Director, let alone all the other things. And Millicent was white. She had all the advantages that any white lady could ever have, and she still got crushed. So if you are sad for Millicent, be sadder for all the other women out there who are black, who are gay, who are trans, who are disabled, who are fat, who are anything that society doesn't want you to be and couldn't get where Millicent was. Couldn't even get their foot in the door. And that's why Millicent Patrick's story matters so much right now. That is why we need to tell these stories. That is why we need to remember these people and show women that, I mean, it's so great that we're living in this Me Too era. I started writing this book before Me Too happened, and then it happened, and my editor was like, how fast can you write, Mallory? I was like, I don't know. I'm going as fast as I can. And then Shape of Water happened, and then I was really like, oh shit, here we go. It was great, it was wonderful. Those are two, I'm so happy about both of those. Thank God for Guillermo del Toro. I wrote the book before Me Too happened, and it really has changed the landscape, and I'm so happy that it is. We're very far away from where we need to be, but things are changing, the conversation is changing. But what I want women and girls and everybody to know is that yes, right now we're pushing to have more female directors and editors and comic book writers and painters and writers and all and any type of field you can imagine. But what we really need to know is that we've always been here. This is not a new thing for girls to be interested in monsters and comics and art and film. We've always been interested in it. We might not have always felt safe enough to say that we were. We might not have always felt safe enough to be in spaces where those things are celebrated. We might not have always felt okay with sharing those things or talking about it, but we've always, always been here. And Millicent Patrick is living proof of that. She shows that we have a legacy here. You know, girls are the most important part of horror because horror happens to girls. In real life, girls are the ones who are fighting horror. So girls need to be the ones who are writing those films, directing those films, designing those monsters, making these things, writing these comic books. They're the ones who have to grapple with them every single day. And if we don't let them make these movies and design these monsters and be up on screen and be behind the camera, we can't show people how to fight the monsters. We can't show them how to win. And that is why Millicent Patrick is so important and has been my honor to tell you all about her today. Now we're going to open it up to questions. Oh, I get to pick the questions. I didn't know if someone was coming around with a microphone. He's wondering if I've heard anything from the Westmores. Funny story about that. It took me 3 years to write this book, and throughout those 3 years, I tried very, very hard to get in touch with them. I emailed their museum multiple times, no response. Until I finished the book, and I'm a huge cocktail nerd, big bourbon drinker. And me and my ex-boyfriend were driving down to BevMo, which is a Los Angeles liquor store chain. And I was going through the checkout line and buying my normal, you know, usual bottle of Buffalo Trace bourbon. Well, I probably should have dedicated the book to Buffalo Trace. And I was wearing a creature pin, and I'm like looking for my BevMo card, and the guy checking me out says, "Oh, you like Creature from the Black Lagoon, huh?" And my boyfriend gets all excited because he's like, "Oh, someone's gonna try to explain Creature to Mallory. This is gonna be great." He loves those conversations, they're hilarious. And I go, "Oh yeah, big Creature fan." And he's like, My great uncle designed that monster. Oh, and it was one of those like freeze frame moments where I was like, okay, there's several ways I can respond to this. But the book wasn't out yet. We were still like, I had a chance to put stuff in the book. So I thought, okay, suck down the volcano of hatred. Try to get information out of this guy. So like I squeak out, I'm like, all right, who's your uncle? My great uncle, Bud Westmore. And he's like, "Oh, you are a Creature fan. You know who Bud Westmore is." And my boyfriend's like, "Oh, this is so good. This is going to be good." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, for sure. Definitely know who he is. And he designed Creature, huh?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, he's the one." And I was like, "You know, I'm writing a book about the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I would love to talk to you because I haven't been able to get in touch with any of the Westmores." And he's like, "Oh, sure, absolutely." And I gave him my email address. He must have looked me up, because he never emailed me. Now, every time I see him at BevMo, he's very, like, he's always like, "Ooh, something's down here, I gotta go." But I do think it's poetic justice that the guy who, the heir of Bud Westmore serves me my bourbon. So that one's for you, Millicent. But no, I still to this day, I've never heard from any of them. Although I will say, before I answer your question, Michael Westmore, I've heard, is a very nice person. He still works in the field of makeup and is a fantastically talented person, but he has never tried to get in touch with me. It is, it's basically Creature from the Black Lagoon fan fiction. It's, because when Guillermo del Toro watched Shape of Water or watched Creature from the Black Lagoon when he was a kid, he always wondered why Creature didn't end up with Julie Adams, which, fair question. He always wanted to write a world where that happened, and that's sort of where Shape of Water came from. And if you are interested in that, I have a great quote. Actually, the only man that I quoted in the entire book, my friend Mike Hill designed that creature, the asset, and I have a great quote from him about Millicent's design work and how it affected him on Creature in the book. No, I ended up not leaving anything out of this book. When I started writing this book, I was very protective of Millicent, and I still am. She's my hero. I've never met her, but she. She means a lot to me. So when I started uncovering things about Millicent that were not flattering and not nice and made her look like a bad person, I really struggled with putting those in the book because I really wanted to protect her. I was working so hard to have the world know about her, you know, and I wanted everyone to love her and to accept her. And like, I feel like for the past 3 years of my life, I've been carrying the banner of Millicent Patrick and trying to get people to accept that she designed the creature, because there are still people who believe that she didn't. I love talking to those people. I hope they fall in a manhole. Millicent Patrick designed the creature, there's no question. I still get asked that in interviews, people still ask me that at signings. It's no question here. So I was very protective of her. And I didn't want to show any bad sides to her because I didn't want people not to like her, and I didn't want to give them any ammunition against her. And then I realized that I was judging her just like I didn't want her to be judged by other people. And women are worth writing about even if they fuck up. Even if they make mistakes, even if they make bad choices. None of those choices ever took away anything that she did for the world of art and film. None of them touched them. You know, she's still worthy, she's still important, she's a human being. So then it became very important for me to write about her as a flawed person. And it made me feel okay with myself, and it made me stop judging her, and it made me stop judging myself. And I realized that if I got to put that stuff in there, maybe another woman would feel that way about her, or another woman that she knew, or someone that she looked up to, or, you know, looked down to. So ultimately, I didn't take anything out. I left everything in there, even the bad parts of her life. Oh, no. Oh, that's the other thing, is Millicent's dead. Sorry, spoilers. spoiling the book here. Actually, there was a period of time where I wasn't sure if she was dead or not. I think that it would be a very different... One, I don't think Millicent did anything in her life that was like... Millicent never assaulted anybody. Also, spoilers, I guess. But Millicent never did anything bad in that way. But if she did, it would be we would be having a different conversation right now. But I do think that we need to be responsible as consumers. You know, people, we're living in this Me Too era, and people are like, oh, well, what do we do? What do we do with these people? You know, you don't have to give them money. It's very, very complicated, and there's a lot of gray areas. But ultimately, no, these people, we can't separate the art from the artist. We really, truly can't. And if there's somebody that you don't believe in, stop giving them money. If you find out that a comic book artist assaulted a woman, don't buy his comic book, because you're not giving him any money, and you're showing the publisher that they shouldn't hire people like that. I really truly believe that we need to start. We can't just be like, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. There's something that all of us can do, both on the positive and negative space. You know, you put your money where you want things to happen. You know, if you're living in a place and there's a director or someone working on set that you don't feel comfortable with, don't give them your money. Don't talk about them. Don't give them space on your social media. And on the flip side, when you're like, God, I wish there were more female directors, go online, find out what movies are playing in your area that have been directed by women, and go give those people your money instead. It's really, we have so much power as consumers that people don't realize. And I think that we can't just live in this world where we're like, oh, well, it's art. Art reflects what you make, or what you make reflects who you are. And so I really, really think that we shouldn't be like, oh, well, you know, guys like Woody Allen, like, let's just, it's fine, they're classic art artists. Well, how many women out there weren't allowed to be artists because of men like that? So that's my take, my very lukewarm take, clearly. Lots of feelings. Oh, geez. Okay, well, that's a harder question, because I have two different pantheons. I have werewolves and everything else. I will match them together for your benefit. If I had to pick five favorite movies, horror movies, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist, The Thing, American Werewolf in London, and it's a toss-up between the original Wolfman and The Shining. I'll make them fight it out. That can scare you?
Yes.
It's an impossible question, because horror is so, so subjective. It's like picking out your underpants for you. Like, someone can try, but horror is the most subjective thing we have, and that's truly why it's one of the most important genres. And I think it's very funny that it's looked down upon, like comic books, as sort of this juvenile art form. Stephen King is the most popular author in this country, and surprise, folks, he's a horror author. If you ever want to see a reflection of an era of society's fears or what they're thinking or what they value, watch the horror movies of that time. It's really the last bastion of art that we have, where we can explore really extreme ideas and be really, really political. And people are like, oh, well, it's just a horror movie. So what's scary to you might not be, like, I'm really afraid of snakes. Terrified of snakes. So for me, a horror movie is like the Discovery Channel. Whereas I can watch some other horror movies and I'm totally fine. So it is a trick question and I'm calling you out on it. I can't pick what up. How many, I have no idea what time it is. So I don't know what that is. Oh, is that like it's like Bratz dolls? Okay, I didn't have, also, I'm like, we didn't have that when I was a kid. Barbies are already like monsters. Like, why do we need to make them scarier? Have you ever seen that sculpture of what Barbie would look like in real life? She's like 6'7" and like with terrifying limbs. Like, we don't need to make Barbie scarier. I don't feel comfortable speaking to that because I have never seen them. I will say that right now we are living in an embarrassment of riches for young girls for horror stuff. There are so many incredible middle grade novels and comics and cool movies and stuff that are fine. Monster High, I don't know. I'll look them up later. I'm gonna say thank you already. Thank you for calling my book. Thanks for spoiling the entire book. Just kidding. That is the biggest spoiler, though. You take what you felt when you met her family and amplify it by a million. That's what I felt. Because not only was I trying to get them to like me so they would tell me about Millicent, this like looking like I do. This strange lady that came into their home. It was so much pressure. I was very nervous that I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to know that I never even showed them the tattoo I have of her. I'm assuming they must have seen it at some point. I'm still in contact with them, but we've never talked about it. Just like I've never talked about my tattoos with my own family. I'm estranged. Because I didn't want them to think I was weird or obsessive. It was very nerve-wracking. There was a lot of pressure. There's still a lot of pressure. I do have another unknown, unsung woman that worked on a very, very, maybe bigger than Creature monster movie, and I am very hesitant to do it because I'm not ready to do another biography. You're basically, when you do a project like this, you are an external hard drive for another person. I am the world expert on Millicent Patrick and it was so much pressure to convince them of the sincerity of the project and to hope that they would open their hearts and their home and their archives to me. And I don't know if they had anything. It was like a really fraught experience for me. I was very nervous. I covered up my tattoos. I tried to make myself look as normal as I possibly could when you look like I do. It was tough, but they are incredible. I'm very lucky. They're incredibly kind. They're so sweet. Fun fact, I changed all of their names in the book to characters from The Wolfman. No one's ever picked that up, which I find funny, but they're all renamed. But yeah, it was tough. I get really emotional about it because I miss her. Ever since I stopped writing the book, she's not in my head every day anymore. And that was really hard. It's just weird because I was like, she was like my buddy, you know, every day. Like I have a framed, I have this photo and this one above my desk, which I had to move because I'm working on a new project. And I'd be like, hey, Millicent, all right, we're gonna do it today. And saying goodbye to her was really tough. And when I started work on my new project, I was like, I'm sorry, I have to move on. I need to feed myself. So it was, everything in this book was a highly emotional experience. Funny you say that. Actually, from the last time when I did when I FaceTimed into the library book club thing, one of Millicent's husband's daughters contacted me on Facebook. So I still have to email her back because I'm still on touring and stuff. But no, weirdly enough, I thought that this book was gonna come out, people were gonna come out of the woodwork. You know, and they were gonna be, mills of people were gonna be knocking on my door. But not that many, actually. I did a signing in Reseda, California, and one of Millicent's best friend's agents was there. And he was very excited. He'd known Millicent, and I gave him my email address, and he never emailed me. I don't know why people don't like emailing me. Talk to me, people. But I have a lot of people who have thought they've had new information about her that has not been new information about her. Every signing I do, some guy comes up to try to tell me facts about Creatures from the Black Lagoon as if I don't know. It's very weird. But so far nothing, but I'm hopeful when I talk to this woman who really wants to talk to me that I will be able to get some new information. But so far, nothing. There. If you read the book, if you have read the book, you know there are a couple places where I couldn't fill in everything that I wanted to. But I'm never going to stop looking for information about her. She is, just because I'm done writing this book doesn't mean she's not still my hero. And I still want to find out everything about her. I'm still hoping, again, that somebody will come out with this massive treasure trove of her original creature drawings, or somebody out there, some collector will, some guy who doesn't want to share with the world will get abducted by aliens and then we can all benefit from his basement collection. But so far that has not yet happened and I'm crossing my fingers for it every day. And I want to thank you all so much for coming out and listening to me speak and for listening to me talk about Millicent. And I hope that what you take out of this, I hope she affects your life in some way. I hope that if you are hoping to do something in your life and you think that you don't belong there, you know that you're wrong. Thank you.